You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Burning down the house here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne here on the 21st of August, a blustery summer afternoon here in Brooklyn in the garden of Roberta's Restaurant. As you can hear in the background, they're having tiki bar. Well, that's one of those things that happens here in East Williamsburg. Welcome. Today, we want to talk about urban ecologies, urban symbiosis with Arianna Bain. Are you there? Arianna?
How you doing?
Hi. Arianna is with a Dutch-based firm, Accept. And we met Arianna at Jimmy Carboni's Shootown to Brewtown about a month ago. And Arianna was so eloquent in what she had to say for the table at which she was speaking that we just had to get to know her. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, very well.
Thanks for having me on.
Very glad that you could join us. You are joining us through the miracle of telecommunications from New Haven, is that correct?
That is correct.
And you are a graduate of Yale.
Yes, I went to the forestry school at Yale and did a master's in environmental science and focused on industrial ecology.
Great. Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about applying forest management concepts to urban design. I suppose you've encountered that, and to a certain degree, I think that's what you're trying to do, perhaps with your work with Accept. Is that correct?
To an extent, it's not so much necessarily forest management as opposed to an ecosystem perspective. Mm.
But forests are one of the largest ecosystems that we're likely to encounter. Correct.
Exactly.
So it's
taking an ecosystem perspective and applying it to the human and built environment.
Very good.
And incorporating the human and built environment with biological ecosystems other than humans.
Okay. Well, in no particular order, Arianna, these are the things that I want to speak with you today. No particular order. I wanted to ask you about a little bit more about your own background, how you came to meet the people with Accept. What's the exact full term of the company? Accept?
It's Accept Integrated Sustainability.
Very good. Which you can find at except.nl. I want to talk at some length about the Polydome, which is something that's really sort of radical and interesting to me. Your firm's concept of symbiosis in design, and anywhere else that our conversation takes us. But before we get going, I wanted to introduce, also we have in the studio, friend of the station, friend of the Burning Down the House, Caroline Bailey. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, thank you. Good to be here.
Caroline is always good as Vox Populi, voice of the people. Caroline is a social anthropologist, and she works in the realm of housing for the elderly, which we've spoken about previously on Burning Down the House.
Yes.
And But because Caroline is part of the extended family slash tribe of Heritage Radio Network, she's in the loop on the conversations of sustainability. And
I have been to the biosphere back in the day.
Oh, my God.
Do you remember that, when they had the biosphere down in Arizona? I went.
Really? Well, there's a lot about the biosphere and the polydome. Things that people are talking about, that if they're not utopian, they are, Carlos, hold on, get ready. If they're not utopian, they are at least Aquarian. Let's have our first musical break. Burning down the house on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I hope you haven't left, Ariana.
No, I'm still on.
Okay, good. We just discovered that actually you and Caroline here in the studio have something in common. Caroline was an environmental science major.
I could have gone to where you went, but I switched majors to anthropology. But my goal when I was a freshman in college was to live in a tree and, you know, save a redwood. And I was in University of Colorado Boulder, you know, trying to save the world.
And you went to Biodome.
I did. Biosphere. Yeah, biosphere. That's the movie. Biodome is the movie based on Biosphere, which is completely
different. Okay. So, well, let's just jump into Polydome then.
Sure.
Ariana, tell us about Polydome, because I read a blog posting where somebody spoke with one of your colleagues and came away with the notion that there might be aspects of Polydome that might just be downright dangerous, but we'll get into that later. Tell us about Polydome.
Sure. So what Polydome is it is currently a conceptual design, and if you go to our website under the consulting section, you can actually download the entire 94-page Polydome report if anybody's interested. One of our principles as a company is that we publish everything under Creative Commons, so it's Creative Commons licensed and put out into the public sphere for both inspiration, comment, and critique.
That's cool, but how are you going to monetize it? How are you going to make any money if you just give it away?
Well, we're not giving it away, and that is one of the important things with this, is that the Polydome report as it is a conceptual design that's come out of our quantitative system for looking at how you can blend a variety of different plant crops as well as
Your qualitative or is it quantitative system? I forget. You said
it's a quantitative model. We actually have a data-driven model that allows us to look at a whole variety of different plants and animals, and amongst the animals, everything from fish to chickens to beneficial insects.
You're going to save the animals, right?
What did you say?
I said your plan is to save the animals, right?
Well, saving them is, I think, a difficult
term. No, this is an ark and only plants are going on it.
I'm sorry, I just got really adorable animals going through my head right now.
So we aren't.
Yeah.
We don't promote the raising and slaughter of animals for meat, but we recognize that that is a culturally appropriate thing for many, many people in many different cuisines, and that isn't something that we, you know, weigh in on.
Here at Heritage Radio Network, that's not a cuisine question. That's a lifestyle question.
Right. They're really into meat at this radio station, but I, as a vegetarian, I'm from Arkansas, where Tyson chicken, I just want free range. That's cool.
Free range is good.
Even just free range.
You have to understand, Ariana, Heritage Foods USA is a meat dealer.
Yeah.
But nice. And Heritage Foods USA owns Heritage Radio Network. But, the way of preserving some of the heritage breeds of livestock is to raise them for consumption.
But in a sweet way.
Yeah.
I mean,
but in a nice way.
Pets,
yes.
And be like, oh, God, Tommy right. was gone last night.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't support
other people eating meat. And we have included animals in this design, and slaughtering them is part of it.
Really?
Oh, okay. All right.
Yes.
What kind of animals would live in a greenhouse?
Both chickens and fish.
Aw, but they get to run around and be free, and then just they don't know what's happening. All of a sudden, bam.
Well, we don't know. We don't know if chickens have a higher power.
I know.
Maybe that's just a penalty you have to do if you're a Buddhist. You have to be a chicken for 6 months.
That's your grandfather you're killing.
I'm sorry. Polydome. So it's a multiphasic cross planting plus some fauna in there. Really big greenhouses.
So the design initially was done as a project for two different organizations in the Netherlands. And the thing with Polydome is that the initial conceptual design that we've put out into the world is 1 hectare, which is a little over 2 acres. But for the Netherlands, that is considered to be an extremely small greenhouse.
Really?
Usually
well, that's
commercial
a really
greenhouses
big...
there yeah. are between 5 hectares and 50 hectares.
Because
so that's between...
As one continuous structure?
But it's a small country, I mean...
Yeah, well, also the sun doesn't shine there much.
This is true.
Yeah.
It is a small country, but it also is the world's second or third largest agricultural exporter by dollar value.
Yep.
Yeah, well, those tulips cost a lot of money.
Exactly.
What are the Dutch export other than flowers? We like to see tomatoes. Ah, very good.
Yeah.
Oh, so what would get planted in a polydome?
So our initial design brings together approximately 50 different plants, both annuals and perennials. And out of those, there are fruit trees, there are bushes, and then there are a whole variety of different annuals, both planted into soil, and some of them in a high productivity hydroponic or aquaponic system.
Hydroponic?
Yes.
Well, Well, that gets into the whole...
It's sad that America only knows that word for one reason.
Because of what?
Marijuana.
That's true.
You're way ahead of me.
I do not smoke marijuana.
You're way ahead of me, Caroline.
I'm so against marijuana.
Is that how they do the grow houses in Arkansas?
I no comment.
So you've heard?
Okay. No comment.
So there are actually a couple of operations, one of them being Gotham Greens in Brooklyn, that are now doing hydroponic greens commercially. cities already.
Oh, sure. Well, you'll have to have bees in the polydome in order to, and flies and bugs,
caterpillars to kill it.
To do the, well, they become butterflies, but yeah, and butterflies to do the pollinization, right?
Exactly. So we actually refer to all of those as micro livestock.
Oh. I think that's cute. I'm sorry. That's cute.
Because what we consider them to be just as essential of a component in the system as any of the other components, and in some ways far more essential, because it literally, you know, we could take out chickens and still make it work.
Right.
You can't take out pollinators and other beneficial insects and have the system work.
Now, what waste product of the plant production are the chickens consuming, or are they?
One of the things with Polydome is that it's a model and it can be changed for a whole variety of different priorities.
Uh-huh. Right. So well, you did say it's a theoretical model. Yeah. Haven't tried one
so
yet.
So there are versions where chickens could potentially be eating food scraps from the post-harvest processing of foods.
Okay.
But there are other models where, depending on what the other design priorities are, where chickens might be eating externally sourced food, and then the scraps from post-harvest processing are being used for high-quality compost. You know, or for fish feed, or a whole host of other.
I'm sorry, tell me again where the polydome is going to be placed.
There is not a location for it yet. We just published this design in early May, and like I said, it's a concept. And what we've been doing since then in the U.S. is talking with a whole variety of different organizations who are related to the food system to understand better where it offers value, really. You know, where it's a useful model and where it's just a design concept that's sitting on a piece of paper and isn't relevant.
Right. Because I'm just thinking with the biosphere, they had amazing concepts and everything else, but what their downfall was that they did it in Arizona, like an extremely dry climate,
right in the desert.
You can't grow shit.
Well, even though it was enclosed, keeping moisture in there, I suppose.
Yeah, but no, it was not a good environment. It was not, and the people running it didn't know how to run it. You have to have every.
But that was a long time ago.
I know. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying this could be a really amazing thing that could take off.
Well, there are aspects that just drive me crazy. I start thinking, because I'm an architect, I start thinking about the fact that rain falls on this greenhouse, but you want the rain to come into the crops, and you know, does the dome open when it rains and then close up, or does it close up when there's too much rain, or aspects of that.
And then all the characters from Tron come out.
So one of the things I definitely want to invite anybody who's listening to do is to actually download the full report, because all
oh man, homework?
No.
94 pages?
Tell us again where to download the report. One more time.
If you go to www.accept.nl and go to our consulting services page, Polydome is the first thing on the page.
Okay.
And you can download the full report from there. There's also a 4-page summary if people want the quick
That's
and dirty
good.
Version.
So the word's still out on where this, if you decide to build a kind of a test center, where you don't know where that would be.
We don't know yet. As of now, part of the way that we're approaching this is to embed what we're doing with other community and food system related work. So as of now, we've been speaking with organizations both in Connecticut, which is where our office is based, as well as the Boston area. And our associate who's working full-time on this, her name is Melinda Stylos Allen, has her job essentially is to identify related organizations and reach out to them and start a dialogue with them about how Polydome could relate to the different communities that are there. So
I got it. So it's in the theory stage, and it's going to be
but they're looking for places
it's going to be a cool.
This is almost too much information for burning down the house.
Sorry,
you're making me crazy.
I regress.
Carlos, can we have a little break? Thank you. We'll reframe and come back.
I apologize.
No, it's fine.
So sorry.
It's okay.
I'm going to kill myself.
Oh, rude. Burning Down the House with Arianna Bain, Caroline Bailey. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Woof, had to reframe my thoughts here. It was going off the rails. We're just having way too much fun here at Roberta's. That often happens. Thank you both for being with us. We're talking about urban symbioses. We were just talking about, for those of you who have just tuned in, Polydome, a multiphasic cross-planting concept for increasing yields. There's been a lot of talk, Arianna, about possibly providing a lot of New York City's food. I looked at a little chart that said the average American, of course, we know that us in New York City and probably those of you in New Haven are not average Americans, but we eat about 10 times our body mass in food a year, and that's a lot of production. For a large city, are you looking into, you know, the sustainability of more locally sourced food as part of your work? Hello.
So I think that that's a fantastic question. As far as we're concerned, looking at Polydome as a way to feed cities is partially a very practical project, but partially also a way to understand just how productive it could be.
Okay.
So, in the context of, there have been a couple of articles about us, and in our own press releases, we've used the idea of how much land would be needed to feed New York City if polydomes were the food production system.
Good.
And that's
good.
A way to conceptualize the productivity.
And how much?
But when it comes to sustainability and local food, I think it's really important to separate out the concept of food miles and the carbon footprint of food miles, which is a very, very narrow measure,
from
all the other aspects of sustainability, whether it's environmental footprint or social well-being or individual health and happiness, out from a carbon footprint.
Well, how much land would it take as a polydome to feed New York? You know, with the chickens and the fish and all the vegetarian produce. I mean, presupposing that New York went mostly vegetarian, but with chicken being...
But I'm imagining chickens walking across, like, a clear floor with fish swimming under it, like tourists.
You could do that. You could do that. I mean,
like,
why not?
Fish.
I mean, it might make the chickens happier to see fish down there. I don't know. But it might make the fish happy to see fish... not fish above them, but chickens above them. I mean, I don't know.
Maybe.
I have no idea what fish think other than they just blink at me in the Chinese restaurant, you know, in the aquarium.
Oh, no.
Like, who are you?
This is the saddest thing you could ever see.
No, I don't mean those fish. I don't mean the fish in Chinatown. I mean the fish in the, you know...
Still.
The high-end Chinese restaurant.
Oh, with the bigger tank.
With the bigger tank where you don't eat those fish. No, but how much land, Arianna?
So one of the things with Polydome is that we don't think it's a solution for ever meeting 100% of food needs, partially because it's not producing a number of the crops that are actually the fundamental aspects of anybody's diet, which are, you know, starchy crops and grains and corn and things like that. Not that I necessarily promote any one of those as a dietary choice, but it is mostly producing fruits and vegetables.
I mean, you can't do corn in a polydome, or you wouldn't want to because the yield's not great.
Yeah, it would beg the question of why would you do this? And I think that that's one of the things with a lot of the current urban agriculture schemes that are out there is that they are potentially very efficient ways to produce fruits and vegetables. It is not an efficient use of either financial capital or resources to put things like grains under glass.
Right, because they... Well, wheat needs a good hard frost to germinate. And that's why the American Midwest and the Canadian Midwest are very good at producing grain. The wheat and oats and also some of the feedstock like sorghum. If we could move over to your analytical approach of symbiosis and design, I'm curious about that. We sort of touched on aspects of that. On your own website, you say the The problem of achieving sustainable society can be seen as a multifaceted prism with each face representing a different category of concern, which then gets into the notion of making ecological decisions based on, well, basic what we call in logic a decision tree. But decision tree, that you have a decision tree, does not always yield a universally optimal result. It's not always win-win-win. Win-win-win may only be possible over time. Over time, some things might have to go to landfills, but then, as Bucky Fuller has urged us to consider, in the future, there may be mining of garbage dumps, and even right now, in Rio de Janeiro, there are the garbage pickers who do a really good job of extracting recyclable materials from their refuse stream. But let's go back to Symbiosis and Design, or I guess you call it SID?
Yeah, we refer to it internally as SID.
SID, okay.
So I want to touch on both the points that you're making there, both about our methodology, and then actually a lot of my own personal academic work is actually with waste and patterns of how waste is dealt with in developing countries. So I'd love to actually talk about that for a minute after I talk about the
Please do.
Methodology.
Yeah.
So in terms of the methodology, it's an ever-evolving perspective, and actually the two people who run the Rotterdam office, Eva Gladek and Tom Boschert, are in the process of writing the actual book on our design methodology. But the simple version is that we, as an organization and as individuals, support looking at any question or design process or project or anything like that from a systems perspective, which means that we look at any question as a series of individual components that are, you know, sort of the object level, like a building or a person or a business. And we like to look at the next level above that first and ask, how is everything interconnected? And understand that from, depending on the context, either a quantitative or a qualitative perspective. And essentially map out those relationships and understand if you look at...
Hold on.
You know, one... Sorry.
Go back to quantitative or qualitative. Or in other words, how much or how good, right?
Yes.
Yes.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. How much are we getting and how good is it? Which is a trade-off in the world of sustainability that we confront frequently here in the sort of tribal context of heritage foods. We're saying, not to distract from what you were saying, but to bring it down to people who are frequent listeners of our radio station, the party line, such as it is at Heritage Radio Network, is you can have a lot better meat product, less of it, but you'll live better because it's better quality and you don't, you know, you're not going to be eating as much of it. That's the trade-off of sustainability to a certain extent, as I experience it, that even in your own home, you might have better quality light or more efficient light, but you might be not turning on all the lights and running up your electric bill. You might be having qualitatively better light in better places, and also quantitatively improving your exchequer. So you were studying quantitative versus qualitative as part of your studies, and how does that then relate to moving forward into the built environment, which is what I'm most interested in? How do we move this into making our cities better or our food supply better?
So to go to the first part of that question with the actual academic study, something that I do is figure out ways to use numbers to look at systems that are usually hard to analyze. So an example of that is the project that I'm currently finishing looks at what are the social relations or social networks, not the social networking sites, but literally the person-to-person relations that support recycling behaviors amongst industrial companies. And so asking, you know, what levels of trust and what levels of communication are most supportive of companies recycling their waste well or giving their waste to another company that can use it as a raw material.
And you're studying that on a quant level?
Also a qualitative level, but yes, on a quantitative level. There are quantitative tools for social network analysis that allow you to actually run things that are similar to correlations to understand how these behaviors relate.
So you're looking at statistics.
It's a form of statistics. It's not the type of analyses that people are used to. You can't use normal correlations or regressions. But
so you're just looking at the raw data. So many companies are exporting their waste stuff to so many other companies. Just on that sort of macro level?
Well, it's actually on the level of mapping an industrial system. My research was on a couple of adjacent industrial parks in South India, and I went and interviewed managers at every single industrial facility and found out all of their inputs and all of their outputs.
Right. Now we're getting into something that's got some meat. Okay, now I understand. Now we're looking at other parallels to the Danish experiment, where there was a petrochemical plant and it had a byproduct, and then there was a gypsum processing plant, and then there was a power plant, right?
Yeah, so that's, I think you're referring to Kullenborg, which was the original example that was brought forth into the media.
Exactly.
Of industrial symbiosis.
Yes.
And it houses the Symbiosis Institute now.
Yes, exactly. So you're looking at examples of, well, you called it social, but really it's industrial networking, yeah?
Well, that's actually where it becomes interesting, and this is where the work of myself and my research partner is original, and there aren't that many people working on it yet. It's applying social network analysis to looking at the managers at companies within industrial networks.
Social.
So it says that there are connections between companies that are energy, water, and materials, and then looks at finding out who are the people inside those companies and how do they relate to people in other companies to understand how the social relations work and how the material relationships move between the companies.
Wow.
Alongside the social relationship.
This sounds sort of formulaic. I don't quite understand it. It sounds like you're able to apply some sort of... Well, I don't understand social network analysis, but we'll get to that in the next segment. But it sounds sort of like applying a formula of 1 plus 2 plus 3 equals a result of how we get to where we want to go. Carlos, could we have the next break, please?
Changing you. to heaven.
Down the house. I'm sorry, I couldn't help but play that. Social network analysis sounds like dating analysis. I mean, I might got this wrong. 1, 2, 3, 4. Tell me what you love me for. What do these companies love each other for, Ariana? I mean, what is social network analysis?
So it's, I don't want to get too far into this lest we not discuss other things, but social network analysis is fairly different from what most people associate the word social network with.
Yeah, it's, to me it's like online, Facebook, yes, or dating, Google Facebook. Plus. Caroline's on Google Plus.
Yes, I am.
I haven't been invited yet.
Oh, I'll send you an invite.
I'll send you an invite, Curtis. So those are online social networks. Social network analysis asks, you know, if I were doing an interview with you or with Caroline, I would ask who you know. You know, I'd ask you, you know, who are your 5 best friends? And then I would ask you a variety of questions for each of those people and ask, you know, how long have you known this person? Where did you meet them? How often do you speak? What do you speak about? You know, very fundamental questions that allow me to look and sort of reduce a series of relations into numbers. And
you
I actually have
questions. I have to step out. Okay, you got 5.
Go on.
I have doubts about that as a legitimate way to look at social systems, mostly because social relations can't be reduced to component parts. They are a lot more than that, always.
Right.
But at a certain level, this all actually comes out of the example that Curtis was citing of Kallenborg, is that that series of trades of waste materials between industrial facilities evolved on its own. And then in the 90s, under the President's Council on Sustainable Development, under Bill Clinton, there was a series of eco-industrial parks that were designed and engineered from greenfield, essentially, and trying to get industrial facilities to locate new facilities in these parks and start to trade waste with each other. And all of them have failed.
Wow, they all failed.
And yes. And so part of the work that I do is part of a new subfield of industrial symbiosis that looks at, one, why they failed, but more importantly, how can we make it so that this actually works in the future?
Right.
And what our understanding is that these individual relations, and this is actually where it starts to relate to the built environment and the whole idea of urban ecologies and how we move forward sustainably, is that these relationships and the way that energy, water, and material move is a very small component of a much larger social and ecological system. And that our entire economy and the built environment sits at the center and inside of what our social relationships are, how much we trust each other,
right,
how much we talk to each other, what our communities are, what our groups are, what our cultural identities are.
So you think that at a macro scale, only Cargill does and buys from ExxonMobil or, you know, something like that, and only... I mean, a lot of the food that comes into New York City comes through Cisco, so they only deal with Cargill and big food. So, I mean, that on a big scale is what you're tracking.
So we do, the kind of studies that I do involve that kind of tracking, but what I'm more interested in on a personal level is how what I do can support things like local ecologies and local communities and how they connect to each other and can become more adaptive and resilient. And so that applies to things like food by asking, you know, what are the types of community relationships that are going to be most supportive to a productive and vibrant food system, for example.
Well, that's really interesting because here in New York, there's a thing called the Brooklyn Grange, which was started by some of the people who own Roberta's Restaurant, who are our hosts here at Heritage Radio Network. And in the back lot next to Roberta's, they have Roberta's Farm. They're raising food. As a matter of fact, it's too bad you're not here. On the top of our radio station are two greenhouses that were funded by Alice Waters. And they're growing produce that goes into the food that they serve at Roberta's. And then a lot of the produce that comes out of the Brooklyn Grange goes to Roberta's, and it goes all out through New York City. And the success of the Brooklyn Grange and the little greenhouses here and the whole social network of let's plant gardens everywhere in New York City has blossomed to where just recently, in the last month, I don't know if you knew about this, Caroline, but you can now plant, you can put a greenhouse on the top of your building, mm-hmm. up to one, you heard about this?
Well, my neighbor did it. Our roof has one.
Wow.
Yeah, in Bushwick.
One third of your roof area can be greenhouse, and mm-hmm. it doesn't count against your floor area ratio. Doesn't count as an extra floor. So you can just ad hoc add growing space with a greenhouse. And I suppose that's a clear example of a kind of a social network relationship that has come in New York, full bloom into a change in the zoning code. Does that sound
That's
like
fantastic.
It to you? It is fantastic. I mean, people are starting to realize that, hey, we can have fresh food. Maybe what we grew on the roof here is enough for our little building to have a little community-supported agriculture mm-hmm. Thing happening, a little CSA thing. And maybe each of us will get, like, two tomatoes, but what the hell?
No, we do. That's exactly how my place is. It's my neighbor, and I love him. He's adorable, and he plants everything on the roof and in our backyard. And we're able to go out, since it's a communal space, and pick what we want. But we have to write down on a piece of paper what we've taken.
Right. Don't take too much.
Two tomatoes.
Right.
Exactly.
I think, you know, those kinds of ideas are actually what, you know, to go back to the Polydome project and also the idea of symbiosis and design as a methodology, is that it's all, for us, it's all about looking at the broader context and asking, you know, how should things be in a broad context, and then bringing that back down to an individual level of a building or a product,
right.
Or Polydome, and saying, you know, what are the community structures and human and ecological structures that support any actual design.
Right.
And how can that push forward a more responsible, humane, and really enjoyable society?
Wow. I think with the trend of farmers markets and how everybody in, like, the Lower East Side or certain areas of Manhattan and then in Brooklyn, people are so enthralled with farmers markets, now it's more of your own building. Like,
yeah.
you can just
well,
go...
Or your own neighborhood.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't wait for that to happen. Carlos, can we have a little 2 minutes of I Can't Wait? And then we'll talk about...
I don't know what that is, but
wrapping
it sounds awesome.
Up. Burning Down the House with Ariana Bain and Caroline Bailey. I am Curtis B. Wayne. We're talking about urban symbiosis, and I can't wait for it to happen. All right. It's true. I push conversations in a certain direction based on the playlist. Although we do have, 63,000 different songs here, and I just call them up. Just kidding. There is a little bit about sustainability that I don't understand about your practice with Accept. It's state sponsored to a certain extent. I mean, priorities are based on curing conditions in a wet and rainy place like the Netherlands, it seems to me. I mean, the biodome is a great solution if you are in a floodplain and it doesn't, sun doesn't come out a lot. But with global warming here in New York, we're madly trying to figure out how we create beachfront property. Your version of sustainability might not be our version of sustainability. In 50 years, New York might be like South Carolina, and we wouldn't need polydomes. I mean, where does all this fit with global warming and the rising of tides? And I mean, maybe this is like a fly ball out of way out of the usual orbit of conversation that you have with your colleagues. I mean, you've saw.
No, this is definitely something we talk about, and I think. First to sort of respond to that, it being appropriate to the Netherlands, yes, the current published polydome report is based primarily on data sets from the Netherlands. One of the things that we're doing right now is, with the next round of what we're doing with it, is developing something that is specific to the U.S. and actually specific to the Northeast and to individual markets in both Boston and New York. And one of the things that is different with that is going to be things like prices, but part of it is climate. And I think, to move to the second much larger question of how does this fit in with climate change, one is that agriculture is, depending on who you talk to, but we believe the single largest source of greenhouse gas emissions and drivers of climate change in the world. And
wow.
So
not
developing
not cars, not buildings.
Well, it depends on, to get into the details, it depends on how you allocate it. But the demand placed by our food system on transportation.
Well, yeah, for sure.
On chemicals, and not actually the agricultural act itself and cultivation, but
moving stuff around.
Moving stuff around, manufacturing pesticides, manufacturing fertilizers, all of that. And also particularly the way that we treat our soils now. And so one of the things that Polydome is responding to is the fact that agriculture is a huge source of greenhouse gas emissions and that we need to get that under control as we do all these other things, like be really responsible with how we raise animals, providing green jobs, connecting with communities. Like, those are all really, really important goals, but they need to happen alongside climate-responsible agriculture. And there's a really open question as to how all of those aspects combine. And as of now, local agriculture and the concept of food miles is only a very, very small portion of what the overall climate footprint of a piece of food is. And it's really important to start looking out beyond that and asking, how do we produce the food? What are the inputs that are associated with it? What are the outputs? And what does the whole picture look like?
And
so that we can have more responsible food.
I would say more to the point, how can we produce the food that we need more locally to where we live. Supposing that we don't have global transportation.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
And so a number of the groups that we've actually spoken with about the potential for including Polydome into the local food system are groups that deal with food security issues and hunger and nutrition, and, you know, how Polydome could fit into those issues and if it is something that meets those needs.
Food security meaning a secure supply of food?
Both I would say a dependable supply of food, again, that is not dependent on global transportation network.
Yeah.
But then, you know, there's always the transition from food security and absolute availability to food sovereignty and the individual's control over an actual supply of food and growing your own food and gardens. And
food sovereignty, what's that?
So food sovereignty is a concept coming out of the idea of food security. And that, you know, a country or a region can be food secure, technically. There is enough food. But individuals don't necessarily actually have control over their food supply.
Uh-huh.
Or have a right to it. Or a way to connect with others around it. And so food sovereignty really takes food security to the next level and asks, you know, can you grow some of your own food? Do you have a right to that nutrition? Uh-huh. Do you have a right to connect with other people around it?
That strikes me as an extrapolation beyond current conditions. I'm interested in the couple of minutes that we've got left. Do you know of any circumstances in which there is food security but not food sovereignty?
I like that question. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, it's like, where is it that there's food that's grown that the local people don't have access to? That would be a condition of food security, but not food sovereignty. Or is that just playing it forward to where the elites have food and the proles don't?
But what's funny is now the poor have the food. They're doing this now because we have the...
Well, the poor people have crap food.
Well, I'm talking about growing. I'm talking about sustainable gardens on your roof type thing.
Well, the poor people.
Nobody cares about what you're doing on your roof if you're poor.
You think?
Yeah, I do.
You went to college and you live in a place where you're growing food on your roof.
But in a very poor neighborhood. A very poor neighborhood.
I think the people in my poor neighborhood on the Upper West Side are not growing food on their roofs.
Huh.
And they eat a lot of food that's shot full of high fructose corn syrup.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. There's that, yeah. From the bodega.
Yeah. They get it from the bodega.
I think in terms of, you know, where, you know, you're asking where is this actually going on, and I think the issue of people actually having access to decent nutrition is a continuing issue throughout the world. You know, it's a mirror reflection between the approximately a billion people who are undernourished and the approximately a billion people who are undernourished but obese.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those are reflections of the same issue within the overall food system.
Yep.
And so it's something where part of my background is after I graduated from college, I went and started a sustainability institute in Bangladesh. And I would say that food sovereignty is an enormous issue in many developing countries where there are land grabs from major corporations and large landholders that take away land-based rights. You know, very well-known people like Vandana Shiva work on the issue of actual land-based rights. A lot of the social movements in Central America in the 1980s were based around a right to land and the knowledge that lots and lots of food was being grown around many local people, but they don't necessarily have access to it.
Right.
And I think that is a common issue in the U.S. today, even, is that
in all countries,
there are many people who live near food and don't have access to it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we've come to the end of our allotted time. This has been Burning Down the House, 21st August. with Ariana Bain from Accept, and Caroline Bailey, just as Vox Populi. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. We've been speaking about urban ecologies. Let's go out with some music from some good old boys from Brooklyn.
Spring at the end of kidding season, goat dairies across the country are faced with the question of what to do with their male bucklings. Because on a dairy farm, there's no role for a male. Often, the most economical thing for these farmers to do is to cull the animals at birth or ship them off to the commodity market. Heritage Foods USA is embarking on a new project, No Goat Left Behind, looking to step in and fill this niche by creating a marketplace for these male bucklings. Visit us at www.heritagefoodsusa.com to learn more and to reserve your goat this coming October.
New York Night Train, Summer Soul Shindig, Rockaway Beach Party, featuring the 45 RPM soul magic of DJ Jonathan Tobin. Saturday, August 20th, 6 to 9 at Grippers, Boardwalk 86. Free party!